The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America is coming unmasked, and red America, Texas and Florida, are leading the way. California used to be Nixon country and Reagan country, so what happened? And did immigrants build America? Actually, no. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I hope you'll click the subscribe button, also the notifications, so you're notified when the next episode goes up. And please share the podcast with others so they can enjoy it as well.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
We are in a whole new ball game of the coronavirus debate, with Texas, with great fanfare, announcing that it is dropping all its requirements, no mask requirements by the state, no 50% or even 75% capacity limits for restaurants or bars or businesses. The state is open for business. All of this is going into effect in a few days, but it's already been, it's a done deal. Now, Texas here is following in the pathway of Florida. Florida led the way. Ron DeSantis, you have to say, took the risk. And I say a risk because it was a big risk. If Ron DeSantis went out front, opened up the state, and there was a massive spike of infections and deaths, he would be in politically very difficult situation. But he took the risk and it paid off. Florida's doing quite well. I was kind of amazed. I was in Naples last weekend to give a talk. I walk into the Ritz Hotel there, and it's almost like I'm in a different country. There's a lounge singer performing, and people are kind of jostling and laughing. And I walk in, you know, heavily masked up and so on, and I felt like a zombie. I felt like a robot. Like, what am I doing here? And I don't think they looked at me funny, but I did sense that we've been living, all of us, many of us, in a kind of alternative universe. And we've been doing it not for a week or a month, but, you know, for a year. So this has sort of altered our lives. But now we suddenly have a shift in the momentum because this huge state, Texas, Governor Abbott has decided, let's go the DeSantis way. And before this, Texas had a mask requirement and it had limits. But Abbott has basically said, everybody who wants to work should have the opportunity. Every business that wants to be open should be open. And that's it. Now, right after Abbott announced that, I see that Tate Reeves, the governor of Mississippi, steps in. Starting tomorrow, we're lifting all our mask mandates and businesses will be able to operate at full capacity without any state-imposed rules. Now, admittedly, in both Texas and Mississippi, the infection rates have plummeted. Hospitalizations have plummeted. And so the governors have had the confidence to do this. But suddenly we now have two competing Americas. And quite honestly, it is really red America against blue America. Why? Because blue America is still largely in full lockdown. Look at New York. Look at California. And so we have a situation. I think it was the economist Friedrich Hayek many years ago who talked about He used the phrase a framework of competing utopias. And what he meant is one of the advantages of having a federal system with a lot of different states trying a lot of different things is we can kind of look around and see what works. We keep hearing, and you know, I saw Fauci, he seems a little grumpy about this decision in Texas. He's like, we're not listening to the science. Apparently, he's the only one listening to the science. But of course, the science itself is only science about the virus. Science doesn't speak about whether businesses should close, whether schools should close. Science doesn't really decide the matter of how an economy should function. That's a political question, and it does require including scientific information, but it also includes simple things like what's the unemployment rate? What's the rate at which the state is growing? What's the rate at which teen suicide is occurring? What's the rate in which students are learning or not learning? What's the rate in which people are actually catching the disease or dying from it? So it's time to sort of zoom in and take a look at that. And I have the data right in front of me, and it's very eye-opening. Now, we're talking about death rates here, and it doesn't make sense to just talk about the death rate in Florida versus New York, because they have different population levels. You have to look at deaths per million, and then compare it across the state. So here we go. This is the actual, these are the actual numbers. Deaths per million in Florida, 1,437. In New York, 2,459. In Texas, 1,520. Bottom line of it is that New York is actually doing the worst. Florida is actually doing the best of the three. And you might say, well, that's because, you know, Florida has, you know, a lot of, it's very warm over there. Well, it's also warm in California. And California has been having problems. And California is basically in full lockdown. Let's also remember that Florida has an awful lot of old people. Florida has a lot of people who are 70 plus, 80 plus, even a surprising number of people who are 90 plus. So presumably these people are more vulnerable to getting COVID-19. And yet Florida is able to demonstrate that it's doing well on the mortality front. Now let's turn to the unemployment rate. Also very revealing. Florida, 6.1%. Texas, 7.2%. Not as good as Florida, but still pretty good comparatively in the situation. New York, 8.2%. California, 9%. So what we have here is that Texas has realized, let's follow the Florida model. We can do even better. And if we can open up our economy, you know what? Let's let the jobs all come to Red America. We'll show you how it is done. There's also the political ramifications. Now, of course, Governor Cuomo in New York is having all kinds of problems on all kinds of fronts. I mean, all this abusive conduct toward women, three accusers now. I'll talk more about this, I think, tomorrow. But he also dispatches all these coronavirus patients to nursing homes, forcing them to go amidst vulnerable populations, gets all these people killed, then hides the bodies, hides the data about how many people died. I mean, this guy deserves to go. He's in big political trouble. So is Gavin Newsom in California. He's facing a serious recall. Meanwhile, with regard to Governor DeSantis, people are talking about DeSantis 2024. In other words, DeSantis becomes a viable candidate for the Republican Party for the next time around. And this is particularly true if Trump decides to stay out of it. So interestingly, DeSantis took a risk, and I think he's gaining the political benefits of that. The blue state governors, Newsom and Cuomo, are in trouble. And I think Governor Abbott says, if I had to choose, I'd rather go the DeSantis way than the Cuomo and Newsom way. And I think he's right. You have been a huge support for Mike Lindell and MyPillow, and it's making a big difference. At a time when MyPillow has been canceled by all these retailers and Mike Lindell is under all this attack, we are one of the people keeping the guy in business, keeping him doing well, and he makes great products. I want to talk to you now about MyPillow and how it's changed Debbie's sleeping habits. She's finally sleeping through the night. She's going through that change of life. She's tried all the other stuff, all the other pillows. Nothing really worked until she discovered MyPillow. She also has Mike's body pillow. The cool thing is that these pillows don't go flat. You can wash and dry them as many times as you want, and they maintain their shape. They're made in the USA. And for a limited time, MyPillow is offering the premium MyPillows for the lowest price ever. You can get a queen-size premium MyPillow for $29.98. It's normally $69.98, so that's $40 savings. The King Pillow is only $5 more. All the MyPillow products come with a 10-year warranty and 60-day money-back guarantee. So go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. You'll also get deep discounts on all the MyPillow products, the Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, and the MyPillow towel sets. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Not so long ago, they were telling us that Gavin Newsom was the new JFK. He was Camelot. He would march his way right to the presidency. California would be a springboard for him. And but it hasn't worked out that way. There's now a really massive movement in California that is aiming to have Newsom recalled. And this is a movement that, yes, it's being spearheaded by Republicans, but it's got a lot of independents, some Democrats, small entrepreneurs who are behind it. And they're behind it because they've sort of had enough. Here in the New York Times, they talk about these two sisters, Alexandra and Daniela Del Gaudio. They own the Wild Plum. And this is a small business, a yoga and wellness place. They opened it in 2018, but suddenly the business has been crushed. I mean, it's been crushed over the past year. They are now $70,000 in debt. This is one of them, Daniela Del Gaudio, 33 years old. She goes, "Everyone is telling us to walk away, but we put everything we have into this. We're banging our heads trying to figure out what to do." So they've decided what to do. They're showing up in anti-Gavin Newsom rallies around the country. Now, California was one of the first states to go into a full lockdown. The signature collectors are already at 1.5 million signatures, and this will be the fourth time that there's been a recall election for the governor in U.S. history. They quote another entrepreneur in the Times saying, "He has broken the back of small business owners." And now, let's remember that Newsom is doing this. You might think, well, you know, Newsom is just so worried about coronavirus. But no, there is Newsom eating at the exclusive French Laundry, one of the best restaurants in Napa Valley, dropping thousands of dollars in his bar bill, cavorting and having fun. And of course, he's like the deer in the headlights when he's caught doing it. So then he apologized. "Oh, I shouldn't have done it." But what he really means is, "I shouldn't have been caught." That's really what upset him most of all. Now, I've been trying to think about California. You know, apparently there are some 40 to 80,000 businesses that have been destroyed. Some of them permanently, they'll never come back. And the question I'm asking is, will California come back? This is an important question, partly because California seems to be sort of the Democrats' model for the whole country. They're trying to make America into California. And we know that because they use California as a virtual model. It's a model for the way they deal with, for example, illegal immigration. They're for it. They try to change the demographics of California, and they were successful at it. And now they're trying to do that to America. High minimum wage laws, enormous regulation of business, confiscatory taxes, high state taxes, for example, in California. When Debbie and I got married in 2016, one of our first questions, I was living in California, she was living in Texas. Our first question was where to live. And California is very appealing. I mean, it's a beautiful state. The ocean is beautiful. The breeze in San Diego is beautiful. Debbie, of course, is kind of a tropical girl. She grew up in Caracas and Maracaibo. She likes the ocean. We would normally be inclined to say California. It's not even close. But no, we opted for Texas. And why? Quite frankly, because Texas is just a better state to live in. It's a well-run state. Now you go, "Well, Texas, what about the freeze, Dinesh? What about the freeze?" Well, the freeze was anomalous. No place can deal with something that is unprecedented. They're just not equipped for it. So, yes, it caught Texas by surprise. But under normal circumstances, Texas handles hurricanes very well. Take something as small as the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles. In California, if you go to the DMV, they basically tell you, take the day off or at least take half the day off. You go in at 9, you're lucky to get out at 12. In Texas, you walk into the DMV and you're basically out in 30 minutes. You're back in your car in 30. So Texas is a very well-run state compared to California. Now, what's ironic about all this is California used to be a well-run state. California used to be a Republican state. California used to be Nixon country. It used to be Reagan country. I remember many years ago, this actually goes back to the 1960s. I read it much later. Harvard political scientist James Q. Wilson wrote a marvelous essay about California. It was called Reagan Country. And Wilson talked about why the life in California was so appealing to people and also why Californians were conservative. And he said it's basically because California gives you a great life in the sun. The ordinary guy in California, not just this rich guy, but the ordinary guy in California, he said, can buy a small plot of land and can have a nice house with two or three bedrooms and can have a small pool in his backyard and can drive a convertible. And so what's not to like? California reflected that big sky conservatism that Reagan embodied. But all of that is now gone. And I think it's all gone because the left has destroyed the state. They destroyed it through ideological propaganda on young people. They destroyed it by ultimately changing the demographics of California, pulling in so many illegals that ultimately they created dependent populations, particularly in the cities. The way they took over California politically, they couldn't take the whole state, but they didn't need to. They needed ultimately to colonize San Francisco and colonize LA. And that they've done. And California ultimately is a conservative state even now. If you had some way to subtract Los Angeles and San Francisco, California would be a Republican state. So the left's formula in California, and it's a formula they really use nationwide. I mean, they're trying to ultimately take the way they win Washington State is by winning Seattle. The way they win Oregon is by holding on to Portland. So they create ultimately these cities in which they create a one-party state. They make the people in the city dependent on the Democrats. So you can't get a contract, you can't get a permit, you can't get a license, you can barely get a job if you identify with the rival political party. And so by setting up these systems, and by the way, there's a certain resemblance between the old Democratic machines of Tammany Hall and the new Democratic machines, which are also in the cities, also based on massive amounts of patronage. But in this case, not even patronage of people who work. Very often it's patronage of people who don't work. So you may have a guy, for example, who delivers the homeless vote. He comes up every 2 years or 4 years and he goes, I'm going to get 25,000 homeless people to vote for the Democrats. And he's their man. He's their liaison to the homeless. Anyway, in this manner, the left has taken this beautiful state, which could almost represent the American dream, and crushed it. And that's forcing all kinds of people to get out. I'm not even sure if there's a way to save California. Seems to me California is, in a sense, headed for the ocean, at least politically speaking. I'm glad to be out of there. I just hope that the question we're saying about California, where do we go, isn't a question that at some point we'll be asking about America. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you must try Genesis 950. The reviews are amazing. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial-strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the kitchen and recently got ink on her pants, and Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon is only available for a 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950, it's much cheaper than replacing your carpets. Is the Republican Party the party of Reagan or the party of Trump? I was discussing yesterday this article by Eric Lendrum in American Greatness called The Reckoning of Ronald Reagan, in which he argues that the Donald has taken the Gipper's place. Now, his main reason for this I agree with, which is that he says that Reagan's approach was appropriate to the time. Reagan was dealing with the Cold War, taking on a foreign adversary, whereas we are now in a domestic Cold War, a Cold Civil War, if you will, and that calls for completely different tactics, a different type of, I mean, Reagan had a fighting spirit. It was a fighting spirit oriented toward Soviet imperialism. Trump had has a fighting spirit, but Trump recognizes that our main adversaries are domestic. Now, while that's all true, I do want to say that I think that there are many things about Reagan that we can still learn from today. Reagan is not obsolete in the sense of his leadership qualities. I want to show a funny picture. This is actually me at a young age working for Reagan. I was 26, maybe 27 years old. I was a policy analyst in the Reagan White House. Now, hey, I didn't have direct, this is my office photo with Reagan. I didn't have direct interaction with Reagan. I got to stand in the back of the room where the senior staff would talk to Reagan. And it was very interesting to watch. I would, they'd be the animated debates about affirmative action and welfare and taxes and so on. And Reagan would be engaged. But after a while, when things went on and on, I noticed that Reagan would emotionally and intellectually withdraw. And I'd be watching him really closely. With my notebook in hand, I noticed that he, you know, his eye would go to the big jar of jelly beans and he would sort of swing the jar right over to him. He opened the jar. And one time I noticed he was pulling out these jelly beans and sorting them by color. And I had to laugh because on the one hand, it seemed like Reagan was like totally detached. But it also occurred to me Reagan is a man of priorities. He focused on key things and he got those things done. Trump, interestingly, fights on every front. Unlike Reagan, Trump engages on multiple fronts. And now sometimes important things get sidelined when you do that. In Trump's case, I think the most important thing that got sidelined was somehow Trump never was able to wrest control of his own Justice Department. That was really to his detriment. One of the things that Reagan teaches us is the importance of political rhetoric, of making the case, of being able to spell out why people should come over to your side, of telling, you may say, a political story. Here's a little glimpse of Reagan doing this. This is from his 1982 speech to the British Parliament.
The hard evidence of totalitarian rule has caused in mankind an uprising of the intellect and will. Whether it is the growth of the new schools of economics in America or England, or the appearance of the so-called new philosophers in France, there is one unifying thread running through the intellectual work of these groups. Rejection of the arbitrary power of the state. The refusal to subordinate the rights of the individual to the superstate. The realization that collectivism stifles all the best human impulses. Since the Exodus from Egypt, historians have written of those who sacrificed and struggled for freedom. The stand at Thermopylae, the revolt of Spartacus, the storming of the Bastille, the Warsaw Uprising in World War II.
I got to say that that brings up a little tug of nostalgia because I do love Reagan's presidential presence, his gravitas, the fact that he is not afraid of the intellectual life. Look at his references. He's talking about the Greeks all the way through World War II. Reagan respected the intellectual life and he included it. He was if I was at Reagan's ranch that the Young Americas Foundation now owns, looking through Reagan's books, and you'll see all kinds of, Whitaker Chambers' book Witness, and Reagan has all these little markings and little writings on the side. So he actively engaged with the intellectual life. The other thing about Reagan is the self-deprecating humor. I think that's what I remember very fondly. 1982, I was in college, and it was a deep recession. The country was doing very poorly. I remember Sam Donaldson at one point kind of cornering Reagan, Sam Donaldson of ABC News, kind of the Jim Acosta of his own day. And he goes, "Mr. President, in your speech, you have blamed the Democrats, and you have blamed the economists, and you've blamed the media. Does any of the blame belong to you?" And Reagan goes, "Well, yes. Because for many years, I used to be a Democrat." And that's Reagan. He had that light touch, that ability to to have the almost spontaneous response that made even Sam Donaldson kind of chuckle, because he recognized that Reagan kind of got him on that occasion. There was this sparring between the two men. Bottom line, we're not in the Reagan era. And an exact replica of Reagan would certainly not work today. But it is also a fact that there are many aspects of the Reagan style and the Reagan spirit that we need going forward. I wish there was some way to sort of fuse Trump and Reagan, and there isn't. But we're looking for candidates who have qualities that combine, if you will, the best of what American politics needs. We're up against formidable opponents, and we need good candidates and good ideas and good organization, and we need a way to be able to reach the American people, not just the people on our side, but also the people in the middle who need to be convinced to come over to our side. Do you ever feel the urge to push back against the leftist media narrative of cops being the enemy? If you support our American law enforcement, I want to share with you a special and very stylish new way to show that you have the back of the police. Eggert Watch's CEO Elon is an unapologetic supporter of police, and he's taking a very strong stance against this defund the police movement. He designed a commemorative police watch that is beautiful. I notice all kinds of special details like the engraving. There's a quote on the back. Elon shared with me that in consulting with officers on the watch design, they asked for an image of St. Michael on the piece. Eggert Watches gives away 15% of all sales from this model to police charities. If you haven't seen Elon's Speak Truth short film on this topic, it's a must watch, and you can get it on the Eggert website. Remember to apply this podcast's unique promo code Dinesh to your police watch order so you can save over $30 at the checkout. Visit eggertwatches.com, EGARDwatches.com, to make your order. It's time we support companies that stand up for what we believe, and in Eggert, we have a company I'm proud to recommend. Liz Cheney, who, by the way, still is in the Republican leadership in the House, she has the number three position. She says that the GOP needs to, quote, make it clear that we are not the party of white supremacy. She goes, it's very important for us to ignore the temptation to look away. It's very important to make clear that we aren't the party of white supremacy. Now, this is not a time, and I don't really want to sort of bash Liz Cheney. I think it's important to have unity in the Republican Party, but unity is based upon kind of a respectful engagement with ideas. I want to ask if this notion is, this approach makes any sense for the Republican Party, you may say, to disavow white supremacy. Now, first of all, the Republican Party is not the party of white supremacy. It never was. It isn't now. The Democrats have always been and are now the party of white supremacy. They invented white supremacy. After slavery, the Democrats realized we need to have a glue that will hold the South in our column. And the glue was white supremacy. Remember, before, under slavery, you didn't need white supremacy. Slavery was the anchor of the Democratic South. But after slavery, white supremacy became... And that's why the Democrats started the Ku Klux Klan. When the Republicans shut down the Klan in the 1870s, the Democrats, it was a progressive Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, who revived the Klan in the early 20th century. All the lynchings, all the stuff done by Democrats, done by Democrats. You may say, well, what about today, Dinesh? What about Dinesh? Today, hasn't there been some kind of a switch? No. The leading white supremacist in America, Richard Spencer, endorsed Biden. He endorsed Harris. He said he was voting the straight Democratic ticket. I told you he would. In my last movie, people refused to believe me. And then Spencer himself came out and goes, hey, I'm on the left. I'm a Democrat. By the way, there is absolutely no evidence whatever that white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan, the skinheads, any of these groups vote Republican. The left says this as if an assertion amounts to proof. They'll sometimes point to a photo. Hey, look at that guy. There's a KKK guy with a Trump hat. This is what they call evidence. It's an anecdote of one guy that they've spotted somewhere in Mississippi, and we don't even know who that guy is and if this is even a valid But there's no data. There's no survey evidence. There's no voter evidence. None of it. So Liz Cheney is asking Republicans to disavow something that has been a trademark of the Democratic Party. But do I concede that it's possible that there are some white supremacists who vote for the Republicans? Yeah, it's possible. Think of it this way. If the Republicans are the party of colorblindness, of not taking race into account, and let's say the Democrats, for whatever reasons, cynical reasons, are the party of racial preferences against whites, I would expect that a white supremacist looking at that issue alone would say, I prefer the colorblind approach, not because I'm a colorblind guy, it's the opposite, but because I prefer that to a party that actively discriminates against whites. So a white supremacist might vote for the Republicans for that reason. But there's no reason to disavow that guy. I mean, let's think about it this way. There's every reason for a out-and-out communist, a Che Guevara type, to vote for the Democrats. Why? Not because Biden is a communist. Not because the Democrats are a communist party, per se. No, but because choosing between, let's just call it a left-wing welfare state party, the Democrats, and a conservative free market, do your own thing, laissez-faire party, obviously the communists would prefer the welfare state party. And yet, do you see, Liz Cheney, do you see the Democrats going, oh, we need to make an absolute disavowal. We may need to make it crystal clear that we are not communists. You notice that no Democrats do this. They don't feel the need to do it. They recognize the sheer stupidity of doing it. They realize that doing it is only going to draw attention to the fact, oh, really? Why are you disavowing the communists? How are you actually secretly communist? So the weird thing is, this is a style. It's kind of a Republican style. It's the beg to be accepted style. It is the let's make it really clear that I'm not one of those bad guys style. It's the style that's constantly drawing fine distinctions. You know, I'm over here on the spectrum, but don't take me to be over there. And you notice the Democrats look at their approach completely differently. They're a coalition. Yeah, they've got moderates. They've got left-wingers. They've got this. They've got that. And they recognize the place of all these different groups, including the communists, in their coalition, but they don't say a word about it. They don't dream of disavowing it. And so, ironically, Liz Cheney, your best lesson on this point may come from your political opposition. I'd like to talk to you about Mike Lindell and MyPillow. This guy has an arsenal of products, more than 100 of them, a wide variety of products, and they're all terrific, and they're all at steep discounts, up to 66% off. I want to talk about the new Griza Dream bed sheets, which are made with this great long staple cotton. Mike guarantees they will be the most comfortable sheets you'll ever own. The first night you sleep on MyPillow sheets, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Griza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors. Like all of Mike Lindell's products, they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. So right now, you can buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free on the sheets. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com, but make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Who really built America? Who was responsible for building this incredible country with all its great wealth, possibility, opportunity, influence in the world? The America that has shaped the world, certainly over the last 50 years. Who built America? Now, we get all kinds of answers to this question. America was built by the slaves. America was built by the immigrants. Those are probably the two most common answers. In fact, Obama was recently doing a conversation with Bruce Springsteen, and he came out for reparations on the grounds that the slaves, at least to a large degree, built America. Listen.
So if you ask me, theoretically, are reparations justified? The answer is yes. There's not much question, right?
Joining Bruce Springsteen in the latest episode of their joint podcast, Renegades Born in the USA, saying
the power of this country was built in significant part, not exclusively, maybe not even the majority of it, but a large portion of it was built on the backs of slaves.
Obama always gives me a chuckle because this guy,
Oh, there's really not much question, is there, Dinesh? It's really obvious.
Well, first of all, it's not obvious. Here is, by the way, the great black feminist writer and an anthropologist, Zora Neale Hurston. She's talking about this exact question of reparations. Let me read a few sentences from her book, Dust Tracks on a Road. She's talking about slavery. And this kind of bluntness you'd never get in America today, but this is from someone that they can't cancel. From what I can learn, it was sad, certainly, but my ancestors who lived and died in it are dead. The white men who profited by their labor and lives are dead also. I have no personal memory of those times and no responsibility for them. Neither has the grandson of the man who held my folks. I have no intention of wasting my time beating on old graves. I don't belong to the sobbing school of Negroes who holds that nature somehow has given them a low-down, dirty deal and whose feelings are all hurt by it. Slavery is the price I paid for civilization, and that is worth all that I have paid through my ancestors for it. Boom. This is the kind of intellectual frankness and bravery that Obama is incapable of. Now, let's look at the merits of Obama. Slavery built America. Really? Slavery built a lot of the American South, but what happened to that American South in the Civil War? It was completely leveled and destroyed. So whatever the slaves built was brought to the ground in 1865 and brought into ground by the anti-slavery forces, I should add. It was the industrial strength of the North who built America to some degree. Henry Ford helped to build America. The steel mills helped to build America. The people who put the railroads helped to build America. The telephone and the telegraph helped to build America. And this all leads to a sort of second candidate that turns out also to be kind of wrong. And that is the notion that, hey, Dinesh, who worked on the railroads? Who worked in all these steel mills? It was the immigrants. The immigrants built America. But my answer to that is, yeah, that's partly true, but even that needs to be qualified. And I actually learned this from a great book that I recommend. It's by the Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington, Who Are We? Who Are We? I don't agree with the whole book, but there's a lot of fascinating information in it, well worth reading. And one of the distinctions that Huntington makes is between immigrants and settlers. Now, the settlers, you could say, were the first immigrants, but here's the difference. Settlers are the ones who build a society. They move permanently from one place to another to create a new kind of society, and they do. Immigrants then are attracted by the kind of society that the settlers made, and they move to that society and they assimilate to it. So the settlers are, you may almost say, the authors or the inventors of the new society to which the immigrants subsequently come. Now, I tweeted this out recently, and it caused all kinds of, you know, pompous comebacks on Twitter. Here's one guy. He goes, Dinesh, define your terms. So I'll define my terms. The Pilgrims were settlers. I'm an immigrant. The Pilgrims built a kind of America to which I, as an immigrant, was subsequently attracted. Anyone else want to tell Dinesh that people had already been settled here prior to the Europeans? This is the good old American Indians were already here. And I go, yes, but they didn't build America, at least not the America that attracted immigrants like me and tens of millions of others to come here. If this had been an America that was left before the Pilgrims came and before the settlers came, this was the America of the native Indians, do you think that I would have come to America and many others? Probably not. And then we have this notion that, well, Dinesh, what about colonialism? What about the history of colonialism? What about the British? Didn't they come and, let me read this. So I guess the British and French were just settling India for all those years? The Germans just settled France during World War II? And I reply, the British never settled in India. They were never settlers. They ruled from afar. They sent people to India, but very few permanently settled in the country. The advantage of being a settler is you're committing yourself to this new place. You're risking your own life, your own family, and your own destiny on it. So I return to my point. Did the slaves build America? In a sense, no. The slaves helped to build America, but that America was destroyed. Did the immigrants build America? They helped to do it. But the people who really built America are the settlers who devised the economic and philosophical and political and even cultural foundations of the country that would dramatically change the world. Do you think there's a coincidence between Biden signing over 40 executive orders in his first couple of weeks of office and the price of silver skyrocketing? No, there's no coincidence. Savvy investors know that precious metals are a hedge against inflation and government stupidity. And Birch Gold Group is not only your headquarters for gold, but also silver. If you want to purchase physical gold or silver, drop ship straight to your door or help converting an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver, Birch Gold Group is your solution. They are the premier precious metals IRA company in America with an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, countless 5-star reviews, and thousands of satisfied customers. And guess what? I'm one of them. There's a tidal wave of inflation coming. Gold and silver are your hedge. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on a precious metals IRA or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. Time is running out, but you can protect your savings now. Text Dinesh to 484848. Evidently, March is Women's History Month. I didn't realize there was a Women's History Month, but evidently there is one. And so I thought I would have Debbie on, and we could talk a little bit, not about women's history per se, but about a little episode in women's history, which leads to our larger topic. The episode is a little exchange of letters between Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, and John Adams. And they're talking about who rules the roost, who's in charge in a marriage. The exchange begins with Abigail writing to John. I'm going to actually have Debbie play Abigail and read an excerpt from Abigail's letter to John. Then I'm going to read John's reply, and then we're going to talk a little bit about it and a little bit about our marriage. We'll see what we can learn about what type of marriages work well. All right, so you're going to play Abigail, so go ahead.
Yes, so she says, borrowing a line from a poem by Daniel Defoe that she knew he would recognize because he had used it too, she wrote, "Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could." So if particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we're determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. That your sex are naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute. But such of yours as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and endearing one of friend. Why not put it out on the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity with impunity? Men of sense in all ages abhor those customs which treat us only as vassals of your sex. Regard us then as being placed by providence under your protection, and in imitation of the supreme being, make use of that power only for our happiness.
Okay, that's Abigail Adams. Now, let me interpret that, if I may, a little bit. What she seems to be saying is that women demand participation, and she's not really contesting the idea of there being a patriarchy, but she's demanding that it be like a benign patriarchy. She's saying, you men are not going to be happy unless you make the women happy, and the way to make the women happy is not to rule tyrannically over women, but to include them in the decision-making process. Now, here's John Adams' response.
Oh, boy.
And, it's not harsh because they're very gentle with each other. And John Adams basically says, he starts off by talking about how he keeps hearing that all these different groups are discontented. You know, the American Indians are discontented, the blacks are discontented. And then he goes kind of amusingly, but your letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, has grown discontented, which is women. And then he goes, depend on it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. So he's actually saying we need to keep the masculine systems. He goes, although they are in full force, you know they are little more than theory. We dare not exert our power in its full latitude. We are obliged to go fair and softly, and in practice, you know, we are the subjects. we have only the name of masters. And rather than give this up, which would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat. So John is basically saying, as I take it, who has the real power? It's really not the men. The men have it like nominally, in theory. But women have all the real power. And so if men give up this theoretical or nominal power, women would be complete and unmitigated tyrants. Tyrants not just in the home, but tyrants over the whole society.
Oh, boy.
Now, what do you think of this? What do you think of this tyranny of the petticoat?
Right. Well, I think he's telling her that so that she doesn't get mad at him. But I'm not sure he would say this in public. And I don't know. I don't actually know that he believes it, you know, because, as you say, they were very loving. And just based on what I've read about them, they had a very, for the time, they had a very equal marriage. You know, a lot of his decisions and concepts and even ideas were hers. And so I think that, unfortunately, no one ever knew about that because he never gave her credit for it. Maybe he thanked her, you know, for being, you know, the person taking care of the household, but he never actually thanked her for her ideas that actually he carried out policy because of. So I'm not sure that he's more kind of trying to appease her.
I mean, it's very clear from their letters that she's commenting to him about the gathering in Philadelphia. You know, in other words, the people who are approving the Constitution. She's writing to him, giving him advice about what to do in France.
Exactly.
So she's not a withdrawn, I'll take care of the household and you take care of public affairs.
Right.
She's actually both interested in and knowledgeable about, and it looks like he does appreciate that, even if it's not in public knowledge.
Right. Well, when we come back, let's talk about what we experience.
You mean 21st century John and
exactly,
Abigail?
Exactly.
All right, we'll do that. Cybercrime is up 75%, and by far the most serious cybercrime to worry about is home title theft. The job of the criminals is easier than you think. The title documents to our homes are now online, so the thief finds your home's title and forges your signature on a quitclaim deed stating you sold your home to him. Then he takes out loans on your home and leaves you in debt. You won't know until late payment or eviction notices arrive. Insurance doesn't cover you, and neither do common identity theft programs. That's why I protect my home with Home Title Lock. The instant Home Title Lock detects someone tampering with my home's title. They help shut it down. Go to HometitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim. Then use code RADIO to receive 30 free days of protection. That's code RADIO at HometitleLock.com. HometitleLock.com. We're back talking about marriage and sort of who rules the roost. And I thought I would pose, we really sort of haven't directly had this conversation. Who do you think rules the roost in our marriage?
You do.
What?
Well,
first of all, we work together on all the stuff.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So in what sense, would you say we have sort of a patriarchal?
Yeah, well, you know, I was kidding. I think we do have a 50-50 relationship because in some things that I'm not comfortable with, like our finances, I think that I gladly give them, you know, over to you to decide all things. As you know, if we make a purchase, I always ask. So in a way, I'm kind of admitting that you're the boss in that department, right? So, honey, can I buy this? Honey, can I buy that? And so definitely not a feminist when it comes to spending money. Although you may say differently. I don't.
Well, the thing about I guess it is true, but I think that's really more just a habit of yours. I mean, can you think of a case where I've said no?
A couple.
What?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I mean, even if I do, it's more like
even if I do, then I go ahead and anyway. No, I never do. I never do. I always ask. I always ask, which is not so much the case with you. But
you mean if I want to buy something, I'll go ahead and do
Remember,
it.
Remember, like when you went through your spending spree of all the books that you bought, like it was boxes and boxes every day of books. Yeah.
This is a very unnecessary purchase, according to Debbie. A complete waste of money.
Yep.
I should be spending it all on lotion, shoes, perfume.
Yeah, no. But I do think that especially for me, when people say, oh, thank you for being there for him, you know, and there's the behind every man, there's a great woman and all of those things. I don't like that. I'm completely a feminist when it comes to things like that, because, or when you say things like, yeah, she sang in the movie, it's like, well, honey, I actually also helped write the script for the movie. You know, I was right behind the ideas of the movie and all of those things, but you don't say those things. And so when people come up to me and say, thank you for being there for you, I don't think they realize how much influence my ideas have in your ideas and the fact that we do everything together, the fact that I produce this podcast, and all of those things are very important to me, much more so than just she sings in your movie, you know? So,
right. Well, in the first movie, you sang in the movie, but you weren't as involved as you are now in the sausage making aspect of the movies, right? And in fairness, I mean, I started this in 2012, the first film,
right?
And but in the last film, you were an executive producer, you were acting. So I think what you're saying is that and you do manage the whole domestic front. In fact, I would even say you change the light bulbs. You pretty much handle the male side of fixing things.
Yeah, that.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're not traditional in that way. Otherwise,
right.
I mean, I do take out the garbage.
Well, if you remember that it's garbage night, you
right.
know, I always have to remind you that it's, you know, tomorrow's the garbage, you know, that those kind of things. And making appointments, as right. you know, dental and doctor and colonoscopy. And yes, sorry, guys. I know TMI. But we are at that age. So, you know.
Well, there was someone who said, this was, I think, goes back to World War II or the early 50s. And he said something like, well, he goes, I've got the real power in my household. He goes, yeah, my wife, she decides what we eat every day. She decides, you know, what our house looks like. She decides where we go for vacation. But, you know, I decide if we are for Mr. Dewey or Mr. Truman. So, in other words,
right,
the argument
right.
here, and it's kind of meant ironically, is that this man has all the power because he is the public persona. But on the other hand, his power doesn't affect the ordinary things that matter most
right.
in shaping
right.
the contours of life. So right. would you say that you're an at least equal, if not tyranny of the petticoat participant in those domains of life?
Yeah, perhaps so. And a little bit of your tyrannical nature is that you hand me this sheet of paper and he underlines everything and he tells me what to read and what
I
not
decide,
to
read. You know, I pick out one section you should read.
This is Abigail. You read her part. Here. Boom. You know, so again, you know, but it's all in fun and I love it and I love
and
you.
And it does bear on the topic.
Yes.
This is the
yes.
topic we're discussing.
Yes. And so, but as you say, we're gentle with each other. We don't yell at each other ever. We respect one another. And I think that's the best marriage to have. And one that is,
you know, when people think about traditional marriages, they often think about, you know, the man ruling the roost. I mean, if I think of my two grandmothers in India, I mean, my grandmothers were completely dominant. Right. And they would order my grandfathers around. My grandfathers were like two obedient puppies, just so you know. But they had a traditional marriage because I think my grandmothers knew that even though they called all the shots, they never humiliated my grandfathers in public. They always sort of created an aura, even an aura of supposed subordination, although every single person who knew the couple knew that it wasn't like that in reality. So my point is that traditional marriages, too, had enormous variety.
Right.
But the bottom line of it was they were based on a mutual respect.
Right.
And they were based on the idea
yeah.
of putting the family first.
Right. I think that's key. Respect and you know, a godly marriage and loving one another no matter their faults. And as you know, I have a lot of little quirks, as you do, but we respect each other's quirks and we make it work.
Digital media censorship has become a major problem, but even if you keep your accounts, you don't have to give big tech websites access to your data. That's why I choose to protect my online activity by using ExpressVPN. you can do social media for free, but do you ever wonder how these social media companies make all their money? Well, they do it by tracking your searches, video history, and everything you click on, and then selling your valuable data. When you use ExpressVPN, you make much of your online presence anonymous by hiding your IP address. That makes your activity more difficult to trace and sell to advertisers. What's more, ExpressVPN encrypts 100% of your data to protect you from eavesdroppers on your network. And the ExpressVPN app is easy to use. Just tap one button on your phone or computer and you're protected. Take back your online privacy with the virtual private network I trust at expressvpn.com/Dinesh. You can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN service for free on a one-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/Dinesh. Again, that's expressvpn.com/Dinesh to protect your data today. It's time for our mailbox. And, in the mail, we got a very interesting video from a young man named Tim Columba, who's a media guy. And it's a video that talks about cancel culture, but it does it, I think, in the right tone, and it's also a call to action. Listen.
Remember when Hollywood was great? Remember when comedy was funny? Remember when our culture made sense? What happened? Our gatekeepers have devolved. But it's not enough to flood our screens with blood, sex, and drugs. Only one reality's allowed, theirs, because you just don't know any better, do you? Oh, you want to live in their world? Well, you better bend the knee and toe the line. And hey, don't you dare think different, or else you're racist, you're stupid, and canceled. You know what, gatekeepers? You're tired. Your dick jokes are tired, your sermons are tired, your pandering's tired, your wokeness is tired, your gaslighting's tired, your elitism's tired. Everyone thinks you're annoying. And frankly, you're hard to watch. You're not our betters, you're just projecting. But go ahead, keep patting yourselves on the back. If you're sick of wokeness and cancel culture, this is your call to action. You're smart, you're funny, you're creative. So what are you waiting for? We've got style, we've got stories, we've got talent and athletes. We have beautiful voices and epic music. We got women and men who kick ass. To the musicians, designers, filmmakers, writers, artists, comedians, and actors, models, photographers, bloggers, and gamers, journalists, chefs, and teachers, let's go. It's time to challenge the thought police. Let's end their reign of fear. Instead of waiting by their old grimy gate, let's join forces and build something new. Look at the potential of just one creative mind. What institutions could we establish if we looked at our own hands and put our minds together? Unlike woke ideology, we believe everyone's free to succeed. No matter how you look, no matter where you're from, your only limit is fear. So gatekeepers, you want us out of polite society? Fine. It wasn't very fun here anyway. But just know this, we're removing your little cult from our culture. The culture is ours to define. They can't cancel us all. You want to keep your freedom of creativity? Look at what's inside your hands. Pick up your talents and put them to use. Whether you're a creative or a curator of culture, let's connect, let's build, let's get to work.
You know, I thought it'd be fun to have Tim Columba on the podcast. Hey, Tim, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you. Very nice video. I must say, I like the tone of it because it's... The first thing I want to say is your tone in the video is unterrified. You're not, you know, whining about cancel culture. You are actively resisting it and you're looking for an alternative. You're looking for culture creation from the right. Now, you have a website that actually talks about ways to do that. Tell us a little bit about where you're coming from and what your website is all about.
Sure. So thanks again, Dinesh, for having me. I'm kind of thinking about other creatives that out there too, just like myself. Think about the best case scenario. I just wrote a book, right? I'm looking for an agent. So the best case scenario is I find an agent, I get published, I blow up, you know, they make a TV show out of it. I make millions. And then what happens? No matter what, I'm going to get canceled. Like it's without a doubt because I'm just going to be who I am unless I let them put their thumb on me and just shut my mouth. So that's not the best case scenario. So I'm thinking about this now that I'm just one person and I can create all this content. I'm thinking about there's so many other people out there who I feel like the conservatives are kind of in this funny standoff right now. Everyone's sort of looking at someone else to start building the culture, Daily Wire's doing it, but I think people don't know where to go. You know what I mean? We don't want to go through traditional film festivals and weird casting couches. No one wants to do that anymore. So I made this video just kind of as a vent, and I sent it to you, so thank you for that. But, you know, then I just kind of ran with it. I made a website where you can go. It's freedomofcreativity.com, and you can go there and reach out. And if you're creative, then just reach out. Send me your business. You know, if you're a retailer, maybe you make jeans. You know, Levi's just is trying to cancel, you know, the Second Amendment. Where do I buy jeans? You know what I mean? Come to me.
So your idea, if I can jump in, is to sort of create new platforms where people can operate and produce stuff and generate ideas in a way that they're not going to be shut down, right?
Exactly.
Now, you had a very interesting idea I want you to talk about a little bit. It's an alternative to what the left does. I mean, Saturday Night Live has been a staple of American comedy, but it couldn't be more unfunny today. I mean, you're literally watching it is painful because you're trying to laugh and you can't. Laughter is something that can't be forced. What's your idea?
So, you know, why not do Friday afternoon tapes? You know what I mean? There's no reason we can't. There's tons of funny content. Just, you know, scrolling through Instagram, there's so many funny conservatives out there. There's this guy, Conservative Ant. He does conservative camp or like woke gulag. You know, there's all these funny ideas out there. There's tons of conservatives who are musical artists. We could feature them on. We have actors. We have, you know, like I say in the video, we have all this different talent, costume designers. Why not have these people come together? We work and we make a comedy show. It doesn't have to be live. It doesn't have to fit their exact, template, but we can build something new, build fresh content. The problem with conservatives is I think, like, you know, we're seen as paper mache eagles and like thin vinyl Trump flags. I think, you know, we're classy, talented people. We can do better than that. We can create content that can compete. And I don't see why not. No one else is going to start it. Let's get together and start it, you know?
No, absolutely. Tim, I want to endorse what you're saying, encourage you, and I encourage people to check out your video. In fact, we got a small piece of it. The full part is on your website.
Correct.
I also want to say that, you know, I see this podcast as being a forum to not only critique culture, but also produce it. So if we've got some funny guys, especially funny young people out there, I mean, maybe you can't find room these days at the improv. Maybe it's too political over there. And if you want to be like the Beatles and go 8 days a week and start getting in training, well, you know what? Make a small video of yourself for a minute, 2 or 3 minutes. Do stand up. Send it to me. Send it to questiondinesh@gmail.com. That's my... You can reach me that way. You can send me video. And if we like it, you know what? We'll play it on the podcast. I mean, I think it's nice to have the podcast itself be a venue for culture creation. And I'm a fan of comedy. You have to keep the comedy clean. But on the other hand, if you can make fun and you can make fun of political correctness all you want, send it to me, questiondinesh@gmail.com, and I'll take a look and I might play it on the air. Hey, Tim, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your time and all the best to you.
Thank you, Dinesh. Appreciate you.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. Or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.